Chapter 3. How Not to Die from Brain Diseases. My mom's father died of a stroke, and her mother died of Alzheimer's disease. As a kid, I loved going to see Grandma on Long Island. We lived out west, so I got to fly in a plane, sometimes all by myself. She was a perfect and perfectly doting grandmother. She'd want to take me to toy stores, but geeky me, I just wanted to go to the library. When we get back to the house, my arms filled with borrowed books, she'd let me sit way back on her big couch, shoes off, of course, and read and draw pictures. She'd then bring me blueberry muffins she made with a big mechanical mixer that took up half the kitchen counter. Later in life, my grandma started to lose her mind. By then, I was in medical school, but my newfound knowledge was useless. She had turned. My previously sweet and stately grandmother, now she threw things at people. She cursed. Her caretaker showed me the teeth marks on her arm where my once kind, loving grandma had bitten her. That's the horror of brain disease. Unlike a problem with your foot or your back or even another vital organ, brain disease can attack yourself. The two most serious brain diseases are stroke, which kills nearly 130,000 Americans every year, and Alzheimer's disease, which kills nearly 85,000. Most strokes can be thought of as brain attacks, like heart attacks, but the rupturing plaques in your arteries cut off blood flow to parts of the brain rather than to parts of the heart. Alzheimer's is more of a mind attack. Alzheimer's disease is one of the most physically and emotionally burdensome diseases for both sufferers and caregivers alike. Unlike stroke, which can kill instantly without any warning, Alzheimer's involves a slower, more subtle decline over months or years. Instead of cholesterol-filled plaques in your arteries, plaques made of a substance called amyloid develop in the brain tissue itself, associated with the loss of memory and, eventually, loss of life. While the pathology of stroke and Alzheimer's are different, one key factor unites them. Mounting evidence suggests that a healthy diet may help prevent them both. Stroke. In about 90% of strokes, blood flow to the part of the brain gets cut off, depriving it of oxygen and killing off the part fed by the clogged artery. That's called an ischemic stroke, from the Latin ischemia, meaning stopping blood. A small minority of strokes are hemorrhagic strokes, which are caused by bleeding into the brain when a blood vessel bursts. The damage wrought by a stroke depends on which area of the brain was deprived of oxygen or where the bleeding occurred, and for how long the deprivation lasted. People who experience a brief stroke might only need to contend with arm or leg weakness, while those who suffer a major stroke can develop paralysis, lose the ability to speak, or, as is too often the case, die. Sometimes the blood clot lasts only a moment, not long enough to notice, but still long enough to kill off a tiny portion of your brain. These so-called silent strokes can multiply and slowly reduce cognitive function until full-blown dementia develops. The goal is to reduce the risk of both the massive strokes that can kill you instantly and the mini-strokes that kill you over the course of years. Just as with heart disease, a healthy diet can reduce stroke risk by reducing cholesterol and blood pressure while improving blood flow and antioxidant capacity. Fiber, fiber, fiber. In addition to its well-known effects on bowel health, high fiber intake appears to reduce the risk of cancers of the colon and breast, diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and premature death in general. A number of studies now show that high fiber intake may also help ward off stroke. Unfortunately, less than 3% of Americans meet the minimum daily recommendation for fiber. This means about 97% of Americans eat fiber-deficient diets. Fiber is naturally concentrated in only one place, whole plant foods. Processed foods have less, and animal-derived foods have no fiber at all. Animals have bones to hold them up. Plants have fiber. It apparently doesn't take much fiber to cut stroke risk. Increasing fiber intake by just 7 grams a day may be associated with a 7% risk reduction. Different strokes for different folks, depending, evidently, on how much fiber they ate. An additional 7 grams of fiber is easy to add to your diet. It's the equivalent of a bowl of oatmeal with berries or a serving of baked beans. How does fiber protect the brain? We're not exactly sure. We do know that fiber helps control your cholesterol and blood sugar levels, which help reduce the amount of artery-clogging plaque in your brain's blood vessels. High-fiber diets may also lower blood pressure, which reduces the risk of brain bleeds. But scientists don't have to know the exact mechanism before you act on this knowledge. As the biblical passage goes, a man scatters seed on the ground, the seed sprouts and grows, though he does not know how. Had the farmer from Scripture postponed his sowing until he understood the biology of seed germination, he wouldn't have lasted very long. So why not go ahead and reap the benefits of eating fiber by eating more unprocessed plant foods? It's never too early to start eating healthier. Though stroke is considered an older person's disease, only about 2% of stroke deaths occur before the age of 45, the risk factors may begin accumulating in childhood. In a remarkable study published recently, hundreds of children were followed for a period of 24 years, from junior high school to adulthood. Researchers found that low fiber intake early on was associated with stiffening of the arteries leading up to the brain, a key risk factor for stroke. By the time these adolescents were only 14, clear differences in arterial health were found for those consuming different amounts of fiber in their daily diets. Again, it did not appear to take much. One more apple, an extra quarter cup of broccoli, or just 2 tablespoons of beans a day during childhood could translate into a meaningful effect on artery health later in life. If you really want to be proactive, though, the best available evidence suggests you can minimize stroke risk by eating a minimum of 25 grams a day of soluble fiber, fiber that dissolves in water, typically found in beans, oats, nuts, and berries, and 47 daily grams of insoluble fiber, fiber that doesn't dissolve in water, primarily whole grains like brown rice, whole wheat. Granted, you'd have to eat an extraordinarily healthy diet to attain this level of fiber intake, far beyond what is arbitrarily determined as adequate by most health authorities. Rather than patronizing you with what they think is achievable by the masses, though, I wish these authorities would just tell you what the science says and let you make up your own mind. Potassium. Take a plant, any plant, and burn it to ash. Throw that ash in a pot of water, boil it, skim off the ashes, and eventually you're left with a white residue known as potash. Potash. Potash has been used for millennia for making everything from soap and glass to fertilizer and bleach. It wasn't until 1807 that an English chemist figured out that this so-called vegetable alkali contained an undiscovered element, which he called potassium, that is, potassium. I mention this simply to emphasize the primary source of potassium in your diet, namely plants. Every cell in your body requires potassium to function, and you need to get it from your diet. For much of human history, we ate so many plants that we got upwards of 10,000 milligrams of potassium every day. Nowadays, less than 2% of Americans even reach the recommended minimum daily intake of 4,700 milligrams. The major reason is simple. We don't eat enough unprocessed plant foods. What does potassium have to do with stroke? A review of all the best studies on the relationship between potassium and our top 2 killers, heart disease and stroke, determined that a 1,640 milligram increase per day in potassium intake was associated with a 21% reduction in stroke risk. That isn't enough to bring the average American's potassium levels up to where they should be, but it's still enough to substantially reduce the risk of stroke. Imagine how much lower your risk would be if you doubled or tripled your intake of whole plant foods. Bananas, although they've been marketed for their potassium content, aren't actually particularly rich in the mineral. According to the current U.S. Department of Agriculture database, bananas don't even make the list of the top 1,000 foods with the highest levels of potassium. In fact, they come in at number 1,611, right after Reese's Pieces. You'd have to eat a dozen bananas a day just to get the bare minimum recommended amount of potassium. What are some of the truly potassium-rich foods? The healthiest common whole food sources are probably greens, beans, and sweet potatoes. Citrus. Good news for all you orange lovers. Citrus fruit intake has been associated with reduced stroke risk, even more so than apples. Say I can't compare them? I just did. The key may lie with a citrus phytonutrient called hesperidin, which appears to increase blood flow throughout the body, including the brain. Using a machine known as a Doppler fluximeter, scientists can measure blood flow through the skin using a laser beam. If we hook people up to this machine and give them a solution containing the amount of hesperidin found in 2 cups of orange juice, blood pressure decreases and overall blood flow increases. When subjects drank straight orange juice instead of the hesperidin solution, their blood flow was even better. In other words, the stroke-reducing effects of oranges extend beyond just this hesperidin compound. When it comes to food, the whole is often greater than the sum of its parts. The positive effects of citrus fruits on blood flow don't require a machine to measure them. In one study, scientists recruited women who suffered from sensitivity to cold weather due to poor blood flow, women with chronically cold hands, feet, and toes, and placed them in a highly air-conditioned room. The women in the experimental group drank a solution containing actual citrus phytonutrients, while another control group drank a placebo, an artificially flavored orange drink. The placebo drinkers got colder and colder. Because of decreased blood flow, the temperature of their fingertips dropped nearly 9 degrees Fahrenheit during the course of the study. The fingertips of the women who drank real citrus, meanwhile, cooled less than half as fast because their blood flow remained steadier. The researchers also had both groups of women plunge their hands into icy water and saw the citrus drinkers recover about 50% faster than the control group. So, eating a few oranges before snowboarding may help keep your fingers and toes from getting as chilly, but while warm digits are nice, the reduced stroke risk associated with higher citrus intake is even nicer. A side note on optimal sleep duration and stroke. Lack of sleep, or even too much of it, is associated with increased stroke risk. But how much sleep may be too little? How much is too much? Scientists in Japan were the first to take a major stab at this question. They followed nearly 100,000 middle-aged men and women for 14 years. Compared with people who slept on average 7 hours per night, subjects who got 4 hours of sleep or less, or 10 hours or more, had roughly a 50% greater likelihood of dying from a stroke. A recent study of 150,000 Americans was able to examine the issue even more thoroughly. Higher stroke rates were found among individuals sleeping 6 hours or less or 9 hours or more. Those at lowest risk got around 7 or 8 hours of sleep a night. Large studies in Europe, China, and elsewhere have confirmed that 7 or 8 hours appears to be associated with the lowest risk. We're not sure if the relationship is cause and effect, but until we know more, why not aim for that range? Sleep well. Antioxidants and stroke. Awarded the National Medal of Science, the highest honor for scientific achievement in this country, revered biochemist Earl Stadman was quoted as saying, quote, "Aging is a disease. The human lifespan simply reflects the level of free radical damage that accumulates in cells. When enough damage accumulates, cells can't survive properly anymore and they just give up," unquote. First proposed in 1972, this concept, now called the mitochondrial theory of aging, suggests that free radical damage to your cell's power source, known as mitochondria, leads to a loss of cellular energy and function over time. This process may be a little like charging your iPod battery over and over each time its capacity gets less and less. But what exactly are free radicals, and what can we do about them? Here's my best attempt to simplify the quantum biology of oxidative phosphorylation. Plants get their energy from the sun. You take a plant, you place it in the sun, and through a process called photosynthesis, the chlorophyll in the leaves harness the sun's energy and transfers it to tiny building blocks of matter called electrons. The plant starts out with low-energy electrons and, using energy from the sun, charges them up into high-energy electrons. In this way, plants store the sun's energy. When you then eat the plant, or the animal that ate the plant, these electrons, in the form of carbohydrates, protein, and fat, are delivered to all your cells. Then your mitochondria take the plant's power-packed electrons and use them as an energy source, that is, as fuel, and slowly release their energy. Mind you, this process has to occur in a precise, tightly controlled manner, because these electrons are packed with energy, and are therefore volatile, like gasoline. In fact, gasoline, petroleum, oil, charcoal aren't called fossil fuels for nothing. The tanks of our SUVs are filled with mostly prehistoric plant matter that stored the energy of the sun that shone millions of years ago as high-energy electrons. And just as it would be dangerous to toss a match into a can of gasoline and release all its energy at once, your body has to be cautious. That's why your cells take these same high-energy electrons from the plants you eat and release their energy in a controlled manner, like a gas stove, just a little at a time until the energy is used up. Your body then passes these used-up electrons to an all-important molecule you may have heard of, oxygen. In fact, the way poisons like cyanide kill you is by preventing your body from giving these spent electrons to oxygen. Fortunately, oxygen loves electrons, although maybe a little too much. Well, your body is taking its sweet old time, slowly releasing the electrons' energy. The oxygen is waiting impatiently at the end of the line. Oxygen would love to get its grubby little hands on one of those high-energy electrons, but your body's like, hold on. We've got to do this slowly, so wait your turn and let it cool off first. We'll give you your electron, but only after we've removed the energy so it's safe to play with. Then the oxygen molecule gets all huffy and exclaims, I could handle one of those souped-up electrons any day. Pouting, it spies a stray high-energy electron sitting out in the open. Oxygen looks left, looks right, and then pounces on it. Your body isn't perfect. It can't keep an eye on oxygen all the time. About 1 to 2% of all high-energy electrons that pass through your cells leak out where oxygen can grab them. When oxygen gets its hands on a high-energy electron, it basically turns into the Hulk, changing from lowly oxygen into what's called superoxide, a type of free radical. A free radical is what it sounds like, a molecule that can be unstable, out of control, violently reactive. The superoxide is just pumped with energy and can start smashing around the cell, knocking over stuff, and tripping over your DNA. When superoxide comes in contact with DNA, it can damage your genes, which, if not repaired, can cause mutations in your chromosomes that may lead to cancer. Thankfully, the body calls in its defense squad, known as antioxidants, arrive at the scene and say, drop that electron. The superoxide fights back. You want a piece of me, Mr. Vitamin C? Bring it! So the antioxidants proceed to jump the superoxide, wrestle the supercharged electron away from it, leaving behind poor little oxygen and its ripped genes. In scientific circles, the phenomenon by which oxygen molecules grab stray electrons and go crazy is what's called oxidant or oxidative stress. According to the theory, the resulting cellular damage is what essentially causes aging. Aging and disease have been thought of as the oxidation of the body. Those brown age spots on the back of your hands, that's just oxidized fat under the skin. Oxidant stress is thought to be why we all get wrinkles, why we lose some of our memory, why our organ systems break down as we get older. Basically, the theory goes, we're rusting. You can slow down this oxidant process by eating foods containing lots of antioxidants. You can tell whether a food is rich in antioxidants by slicing it open, exposing it to air, oxygen, and then seeing what happens. If it turns brown, it's oxidizing. Think about our two most popular fruits, apples and bananas. They turn brown quickly, which means there aren't a lot of antioxidants inside them. Most of the antioxidants in apples are in the peels. Cut open a mango, and what happens? Nothing happens, because there's lots of antioxidants in there. How do you keep your fruit salad from turning brown? By adding lemon juice, which contains the antioxidant vitamin C. Antioxidants can keep your food from oxidizing, and they may do the same inside your body. One of the diseases antioxidant-rich foods may help prevent is stroke. Swedish researchers followed more than 30,000 older women over a period of a dozen years and found that those who ate the most antioxidant-rich foods had the lowest stroke risk. Similar findings were reported in a younger cohort of men and women in Italy. As with lung disease, antioxidant supplements don't appear to help. Mother Nature's powers cannot be stuffed into a pill. Knowing this, scientists set out to find the most antioxidant-rich foods. 16 researchers spanning the globe published a database of the antioxidant power of more than a whopping 3,000 foods, beverages, herbs, spices, and supplements. They tested everything from Captain Crunch cereal to the crushed dried leaves of the African baobab tree. They tested dozens of brands of beer to see which had the most antioxidants. Santa Claus beer from Eggenberg, Austria, tied for first place. Sadly, beer represents Americans' fourth largest source of dietary antioxidants. You can check out the list to see where your favorite foods and beverages rank at bit.ly/antioxidantfoods. No need to post the 138-page chart on your fridge, though. Here's the simple rule. On average, plant foods contain 64 times more antioxidants than animal foods. As the researchers put it, quote, antioxidant-rich foods originate from the plant kingdom, while meat, fish, and other foods from the animal kingdom are low in antioxidants, unquote. Even the least healthy plant food I can think of, good old American iceberg lettuce, which is like 96% water, contains 17 units, decamicromoles using a modified FRAP assay, of antioxidant power. Some berries have more than 1,000 units, to give you some perspective, making iceberg look pretty pathetic. But compare iceberg lettuce, 17 units, to fresh salmon, which only has 3 units. Chicken, as few as 5 units of antioxidant power. Skim milk or hard-boiled egg, just 4 units. And egg beaters has a big old goose egg, 0 units. Quote, diets composed mainly of animal-based foods are thus low in antioxidant content, conclude the research team, while diets based mainly on a variety of plant-based foods are antioxidant-rich due to the thousands of bioactive antioxidant phytochemicals found in plants, which are conserved in many foods and beverages, unquote. There's no need to necessarily cherry-pick individual foods to boost your antioxidant intake, though cherries do have up to 714. You can simply strive to include a variety of fruits, vegetables, herbs, and spices at every meal. That way, you can continuously flood your body with antioxidants to help ward off stroke and other age-related diseases. A side note, antioxidants in a pinch. The food category that averages the most antioxidants is herbs and spices. Let's say you prepare a nice healthy bowl of whole wheat pasta with marinara sauce. Together, they may achieve a score of about 80 units of antioxidant power, and approximately 20 units from the pasta and 60 from the sauce. Add in a handful of steamed broccoli florets, and you may end up with a delicious 150-unit meal. Not bad. Now sprinkle on a single teaspoon of dried oregano or marjoram, oregano's sweeter and milder twin. That alone could double your meal's antioxidant power up to more than 300 units. How about a bowl of oatmeal for breakfast? By adding just a half teaspoon of cinnamon, you could bring the antioxidant power of your meal from 20 units to 120 units. And if you can stand the punch, adding even a pinch of cloves could bring your unassuming breakfast up to an antioxidant score of 160 units. Plant-based meals tend to be rich in antioxidants on their own, but taking a moment to spice up your life may make your meal even healthier. Antioxidant-rich diets appear to protect against stroke by preventing the circulation of oxidized fats in the bloodstream that can damage the sensitive walls of small blood vessels in the brain. They can also help decrease artery stiffness, prevent blood clots from forming, and lower blood pressure and inflammation. Free radicals can disfigure proteins in our bodies to the extent they become unrecognizable by our immune systems. The inflammatory response this triggers can be prevented by saturating our bodies with sufficient antioxidants. Whereas all whole plant foods may have anti-inflammatory effects, some plants are better than others. High antioxidant fruits and vegetables, such as berries and greens, have been found to douse systemic inflammation significantly better than the same number of servings of more common low antioxidant fruits and veggies, such as bananas and lettuce. The foods we choose make a difference. Alzheimer's disease. In my clinical practice, the one diagnosis I dreaded, giving more than cancer, was Alzheimer's. It wasn't just because the psychological toll to come for the patient, but because of the emotional toll that would be placed on loved ones. The Alzheimer's Foundation estimates that 15 million friends and family members supply more than 15 billion unpaid hours annually caring for loved ones who may not even recognize them. Despite the billions of dollars spent on research, there's still neither a cure nor an effective treatment for the disease, which invariably progresses to death. In short, Alzheimer's is reaching a state of crisis, emotionally, economically, even scientifically. Over the past two decades, more than 73,000 research articles have been published on the disease. That's about 100 articles a day. Yet very little clinical progress has been made in treating or even understanding it, and a total cure is likely impossible, given that lost cognitive function in Alzheimer's patients may never be regained due to fatally damaged neuronal networks. Dead nerve cells cannot be brought back to life. Even if drug companies can figure out how to halt the disease's progression, for many patients the damage has already been done, and the individual's personality may be lost forever. The good news, as a senior scientist at the Center for Alzheimer's Research entitled a research article, is that Alzheimer's disease is incurable but preventable. Diet and lifestyle changes could potentially prevent millions of cases a year. How? There's an emerging consensus that what is good for our hearts is also good for our heads, because clogging of the arteries inside the brain with atherosclerotic plaque is thought to play a pivotal role in the development of Alzheimer's disease. It's not surprising, then, that the dietary centerpiece of the 2014 Dietary and Lifestyle Guidelines for the Prevention of Alzheimer's Disease, published in the journal Neurobiology of Aging, was, quote, "vegetables, legumes, beans, peas, and lentils, fruits, and whole grains should replace meats and dairy products as primary staples of the diet." Is Alzheimer's a vascular disorder? In 1901, a woman named Augusta was taken to an insane asylum in Frankfurt, Germany, by her husband. She was described as a delusional, forgetful, disoriented woman who could not carry out her homemaking duties. She was seen by Dr. Alzheimer and was to become the subject of the case that made Alzheimer a household name. On autopsy, Alzheimer described the plaques and tangles in her brain that would go on to characterize the disease. But lost in the excitement of discovering a new disease, a clue may have been overlooked. He wrote, in translated German, "The larger cerebral vessels show arteriosclerotic change." He was describing the hardening of the arteries inside the patient's brain. We generally think of atherosclerosis as a condition of the heart, but it's been described as an omnipresent pathology that involves virtually the entire human organism. You have blood vessels in every one of your organs, including your brain. The concept of cardiogenic dementia, first proposed in the 1970s, suggested that because the aging brain is highly sensitive to a lack of oxygen, lack of adequate blood flow may lead to cognitive decline. Today, we have a substantial body of evidence strongly associating atherosclerotic arteries with Alzheimer's disease. Autopsies have shown repeatedly that Alzheimer's patients tend to have significantly more atherosclerotic plaque buildup and narrowing of the arteries within the brain. Normal resting cerebral blood flow, the amount of blood circulating to the brain, is typically about a quart a minute. Starting in adulthood, people appear to naturally lose about 0.5% of blood flow per year. So by age 65, the circulating capacity could be down by as much as 20%. While such a drop alone may not be sufficient to impair brain function, it can put you close to the edge. The clogging of the arteries inside and leading to the brain with cholesterol-filled plaque can drastically reduce the amount of blood, and therefore oxygen, your brain receives. Supporting the theory, autopsies have demonstrated that Alzheimer's patients had particularly significant arterial blockage in the arteries leading to the memory centers of their brains. In light of such findings, some experts have even suggested that Alzheimer's be reclassified as a vascular disorder. There are limitations to how much we can glean from autopsy studies, however. For example, perhaps a person's dementia led to his or her poor diet rather than vice versa. To further assess the role of clogged brain arteries in the development of Alzheimer's, researchers followed about 400 people who were just starting to lose their mental faculties, which is called mild cognitive impairment. Special brain artery scans were employed to evaluate the amount of arterial blockage in each patient's brain. The researchers found that the cognition and daily functioning of those with the least narrowing of the arteries in their heads remained stable over the course of the 4-year study. Meanwhile, subjects with more arterial blockage lost significant brain function, and those with the worst cases of plaque buildup declined rapidly, doubling their likelihood of progressing to full-blown Alzheimer's. The researchers concluded, quote, "An inefficient blood supply to the brain has very grave consequences on brain function." A study of 300 Alzheimer's patients found that treating vascular risk factors, such as high cholesterol and blood pressure, may even slow the progression of the disease, but not stop it. That's why prevention is the key. Cholesterol doesn't just help generate atherosclerotic plaques within your brain arteries. It may help seed the amyloid plaques that riddle the brain tissue of Alzheimer's victims. Cholesterol is a vital component of your cells, which is why your body makes all that you need. Consuming excess cholesterol, and especially trans and saturated fats, can raise your blood cholesterol level. Too much cholesterol in your blood is not only considered the primary risk factor for heart disease, but is also unanimously recognized as a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. Autopsies have revealed that Alzheimer's brains have significantly more cholesterol buildup than normal brains. We used to think that the pool of cholesterol in the brain was separate from the cholesterol circulating in the blood, but there is now growing evidence to the contrary. Excess cholesterol in the blood can lead to excess cholesterol in the brain, which can then help trigger the clumping of amyloid seen in Alzheimer's brains. Under an electron microscope, we can see the clustering of amyloid fibers on and around tiny crystals of cholesterol. And indeed, advanced brain imaging techniques such as PET scans have shown a direct correlation between the amount of LDL, bad cholesterol, in the blood and amyloid buildup in the brain. Drug companies have hoped to capitalize on this connection to sell cholesterol-lowering statin drugs to help prevent Alzheimer's, but statins themselves can cause cognitive impairment, including short and long-term memory loss. For people unwilling to change their diets, the benefits of statins outweigh the risks, but it's better to lower your cholesterol levels naturally by eating healthier to help preserve your heart, brain, and mind. Genetics or diet? This dietary concept may be surprising because most of the popular press today treats Alzheimer's as a genetic disease. They say it's in your genes rather than your lifestyle choices that determines whether or not you'll succumb. However, when you examine the distribution of Alzheimer's disease around the world, that argument begins to crumble. The rates of Alzheimer's vary tenfold around the world, even taking into account that some populations live longer than others. For example, in rural Pennsylvania, if you knew 100 senior citizens, it's likely that, on average, 19 of them would develop Alzheimer's disease within the next decade. However, that number would probably be closer to just 3 out of 100 if you lived in rural India. How do we know that some populations aren't just more genetically susceptible? Because of migration studies in which disease rates within the same ethnic group are compared between their current locale and their homeland. For example, the Alzheimer's rates among Japanese men living in the United States are significantly higher than those of Japanese men living in Japan. The Alzheimer's rates among Africans in Nigeria are up to 4 times lower than those of African Americans in Indianapolis. Why does living in the United States increase dementia risk? The balance of evidence suggests that the answer lies in the American diet. Of course, in our new global world, you don't have to move to the West to adopt a Western diet. In Japan, the prevalence of Alzheimer's has shot up over the past few decades, thought to be due to the shift from a traditional rice and vegetable-based diet to one featuring triple the dairy and 6 times the meat. The closest correlation researchers found between diet and dementia was animal fat consumption. Animal fat intake shot up nearly 600% between 1961 and 2008. A similar trend linking diet and dementia was found in China. With diets westernizing globally, Alzheimer's rates are expected to continue to increase, writes one researcher in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, quote, unless dietary patterns change to those with less reliance on animal products. The lowest validated rates of Alzheimer's disease in the world are found in rural India, where people eat traditional, plant-based diets centered on grains and vegetables. In the United States, those who don't eat meat, including poultry and fish, appear to cut their risk of developing dementia in half. And the longer meat is avoided, the lower dementia risk may fall. Compared to those eating meat more than 4 times a week, those who have eaten vegetarian diets for 30 years or more had 3 times lower risk of becoming demented. Surely genetic factors play some part. They do. Back in the 1990s, scientists discovered a gene variant called apolipoprotein E4, or APOE4, that makes you more susceptible to getting Alzheimer's. Everyone has some form of APOE, but about 1 in 7 people have a copy of the E4 gene that's linked to the disease. It's been shown that if you inherit one APOE4 gene from your mother or father, your risk of getting Alzheimer's may triple. If you get the APOE4 gene from both parents, which is about 1 in 50 people do, you might end up with 9 times the risk. What does the APOE gene do? It makes the protein that's the principal cholesterol carrier in the brain. The E4 variant may lead to an abnormal accumulation of cholesterol within brain cells, which could trigger Alzheimer's pathology. This mechanism may explain the so-called Nigerian paradox. The highest frequency of the APOE4 variant occurs in Nigerians, who surprisingly also have some of the lowest rates of Alzheimer's. Wait a second. The population with the highest rate of the Alzheimer's gene has one of the lowest rates of Alzheimer's disease? This contradiction may be explained by Nigerians' extremely low blood cholesterol levels, thanks to a diet low in animal fat and consisting mainly of grains and vegetables. So it seems diet can trump genetics. Consider that in one study of 1,000 people over a period of 2 decades, the presence of the APOE4 gene, unsurprisingly, was found to more than double the odds of Alzheimer's. But in those same subjects, high blood cholesterol was found to nearly triple the odds. The researchers suspect that controlling such risk factors as high blood pressure and cholesterol could substantially reduce the risk of Alzheimer's, dropping the odds from up to around 9-fold with the dreaded double-barreled APOE4 down to just 2x the risk. Too often, doctors and patients have a fatalistic approach to chronic degenerative diseases, and Alzheimer's is no exception. It's all in your genes, they say, and what will happen will happen. Research shows that although you might have been dealt some bad genetic cards, you may be able to reshuffle the deck with diet. Preventing Alzheimer's with plant foods. Alzheimer's manifests as a disease of the elderly, but like heart disease and most cancers, it's a disease that may take decades to develop. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, or should I say MP3 glitch, it's never too early to start eating healthier. Dietary decisions you make now may directly influence your health much later in life, including the health of your brain. Most Alzheimer's sufferers aren't diagnosed until they're in their 70s, but we now know that their brains began deteriorating long before that. Based on thousands of autopsies, pathologists seem to detect the first silent stages of Alzheimer's disease, what appear to be tangles in the brain, in half of people by age 50, and even 10% of those in their 20s. The good news is that the clinical manifestations of Alzheimer's disease, like heart disease, lung disease, and stroke, may be preventable. Plant-based diets are recommended in Alzheimer's prevention guidelines because of which foods they tend to accentuate and which they tend to reduce. The Mediterranean diet, for example, which is higher in vegetables, beans, fruits, and nuts, and lower in meat and dairy products, has been associated with slower cognitive decline and lower risk of Alzheimer's. When researchers tried to tease out the protective components, the critical ingredients appeared to be the diet's high vegetable content and lower ratio of saturated to unsaturated fats. This conclusion aligns with that of the Harvard Women's Health Study, which found that higher saturated fat intake, sourced predominantly from dairy, meat, and processed foods, was associated with a significantly worse trajectory of cognition and memory. Women with the highest saturated fat intake had a 60 to 70% greater chance of cognitive deterioration over time. Women with the lowest saturated fat intake had the brain function on average of women 6 years younger. The benefits of a plant-based diet may also be due to the plants themselves. Whole plant foods contain thousands of compounds with antioxidant properties, some of which can traverse the blood-brain barrier and may provide a neuroprotective effect by defending against free radicals, that is, protecting against the rusting of the brain. Your brain is only about 2% of your body weight, but may consume up to 50% of the oxygen you breathe, potentially releasing a firestorm of free radicals. Special antioxidant pigments in berries and dark green leafies may make them the brain foods of the fruit and vegetable kingdom. The first study to show that blueberries improve memory abilities in older adults exhibiting early cognitive deterioration was published in 2010. Then in 2012, Harvard University researchers actually quantified these findings by using data from the Nurses Health Study, in which the diets and health of 16,000 women were followed starting in 1980. They found that women who consumed at least one serving of blueberries and two servings of strawberries a week had slower rates of cognitive decline, by as much as 2.5 years, compared to those that didn't eat berries. These results suggest that simply eating a handful of berries every day, one easy and delicious dietary tweak, may slow your brain's aging by more than 2 years. Even just drinking fruit and vegetable juices may be beneficial. A study that followed nearly 2,000 people for about 8 years found that people who drank fruit and vegetable juices regularly appeared to have a 76% lower risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Quote, fruit and vegetable juices may play an important role in delaying the onset of Alzheimer's disease, the researchers concluded, particularly among those who are at high risk for the disease. The researchers suspect the active ingredient may be a class of powerful brain-accessing antioxidants called polyphenols. If that's the case, Concord grape juice, like purple grape juice, may be the best choice, although whole fruits are generally preferable to juices. Concord grapes aren't always in season, though, so look for cranberries, which are also packed with polyphenols and can typically be found frozen year-round. Later in this audiobook, I offer a pink juice recipe for a whole food cranberry cocktail with 25 times fewer calories and at least 8 times the phytonutrient content of store-bought cranberry juice. Beyond their antioxidant activity, polyphenols have been shown to protect nerve cells in vitro by inhibiting the formation of plaques and tangles that characterize Alzheimer's brain pathology. In theory, they could also pull out metals that accumulate in certain brain areas and may play a role in the development of Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases. Polyphenols are one of the reasons I make specific recommendations for berries and green tea in Part 2. A side note on treating Alzheimer's with saffron. Despite the billions poured into Alzheimer's research, there's no effective treatment to reverse the progression of the disease. There are medications that can help manage the symptoms, though, and so can something found right in the grocery store. Although some remarkable benefits have been reported in anecdotal case studies with the spice turmeric, the best data we have on spice-based interventions for Alzheimer's is for saffron, a spice derived from the flower of Crocus sativus. Saffron was found in a double-blind trial to help diminish the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. In a 16-week study, Alzheimer's patients with mild to moderate dementia who took saffron capsules displayed significantly better cognitive function on average than a group of patients who took a placebo. How about putting saffron head-to-head against one of the most popular Alzheimer's drugs on the market, donepezil, commonly marketed under the brand name Aricept? A 22-week double-blind study, meaning that neither the researchers nor the subjects knew who was on the drug and who was on the spice until the study's conclusion, found that saffron appears just as effective at treating Alzheimer's symptoms as the leading drug. Unfortunately, working just as well as medication isn't saying much, but at least a person doesn't have to risk the drug's side effects, most typically nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. While there is no proven way to halt the progression of Alzheimer's, if you do know anyone suffering from the disease, regularly cooking him or her saffron-spiced paella may help. Gerontotoxins. Each of us contains tens of billions of miles of DNA, enough for 100,000 round trips to the moon if you uncoil each strand and place them end to end. How do our bodies keep it from all getting tangled up? Enzymes, known as sirtuins, keep our DNA wrapped up nice and neat around spool-like proteins. Although they were only discovered recently, sirtuins represent one of the most promising areas of medicine, as they appear to be involved in promoting healthy aging and longevity. Autopsy studies show the loss of sirtuin activity is closely associated with the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, namely the accumulation of plaques and tangles in the brain. Suppression of this key host defense is considered a central feature of Alzheimer's. The pharmaceutical industry is trying to come up with drugs to increase sirtuin activity, but why not just prevent its suppression in the first place? You may be able to do this by reducing your dietary exposure to advanced glycation end products, or AGEs. AGE is an appropriate acronym, as they are considered gerontotoxins, meaning aging toxins, from the Greek geros, meaning old age, as in geriatric. AGEs are thought to accelerate the aging process by cross-linking proteins together, causing tissue stiffness, oxidative stress, and inflammation. This process may play a role in cataract formation and macular degeneration in the eye, as well as damage to the bones, heart, kidneys, and liver. They may also impact the brain, appearing to accelerate the slow shrinkage of your brain as you age and suppressing your sirtuin defenses. Older adults with high levels of AGEs in their blood or urine appear to suffer an accelerated loss of cognitive function over time. Elevated levels of AGEs are also found in the brains of Alzheimer's victims. Where are these AGEs coming from? Some are produced and detoxified naturally in your body, but other than cigarette smoke, major sources are meat and meat-derived products exposed to dry heat cooking methods. AGEs are formed primarily when fat and protein-rich foods are exposed to high temperatures. More than 500 foods have been tested for AGE content. Everything from Big Macs and Hot Pockets to coffee and Jell-O. In general, meat, cheese, and highly processed foods had the highest AGE content, and grains, beans, breads, vegetables, fruits, and milk had the least. The top 20 most AGE-contaminated products per serving tested were various brands of number 1, barbecue chicken, number 2, bacon, number 3, broiled hot dog, number 4, roasted chicken thigh, then roasted chicken leg, pan-fried steak, oven-fried chicken breast, then deep-fried chicken breast, stir-fried steak strips, then McDonald's Chicken Selects breast strips, then pan-fried turkey burger, number 12 barbecue chicken again, then oven-fried chicken, then oven-fried fish, McDonald's Chicken McNuggets, broiled chicken, pan-fried turkey burger, baked chicken, then pan-fried turkey burger again, boiled hot dog, and number 20 broiled steak. You get the idea. Yes, cooking methods matter. A baked apple has 3 times more AGEs than a raw apple, and a broiled hot dog has more than a boiled hot dog. But the source is what matters most. A baked apple has 45 units of AGEs compared to a raw apple's 13 units, while a broiled hot dog has 10,143 units compared to a boiled hot dog's 6,736. The researchers recommend cooking meat using moist heat cooking methods, such as steaming or stewing, but even boiled fish has more than 10 times more AGEs than a sweet potato roasted for an hour. Meat averages about 20 times more AGEs than highly processed foods like breakfast cereals and about 150 times more than fresh fruits and vegetables. Poultry was the worst, containing about 20% more AGEs than beef. The researchers concluded that even a modest reduction in meat intake could realistically cut daily AGE intake in half. Because sirtuin suppression is both preventable and reversible by AGE reduction, avoiding high AGE foods is seen as potentially offering a new strategy to combat the Alzheimer's epidemic. A side note, halting cognitive decline with exercise? There is exciting news for people on the verge of losing their mental faculties. In a 2010 study published in the Archives of Neurology, researchers took a group of people with mild cognitive impairment, those who start to forget things, for example, or regularly repeating themselves, and had them engage in aerobic exercise for 45 to 60 minutes a day, 4 times a week, for 6 months. The control group was instructed to simply stretch for the same time periods. Memory tests were performed before and after the study. Researchers found that in the control stretching group, cognitive function continued to decline. But the exercising group not only didn't get worse, they got better. The exercisers got more test answers correct after 6 months, indicating their memory had improved. Subsequent studies using MRI scans found that aerobic exercise can actually reverse age-related shrinkage in the memory centers of the brain. No such effect was found in the stretching or toning control groups or a non-aerobic strength training group. Aerobic exercise can help improve cerebral blood flow, improve memory performance, and help preserve brain tissue. Let's face it, a life without memories is not much of a life. Whether those memories are lost all at once from a massive stroke, chipped away by mini strokes that leave little holes in the brain, or destroyed from within by degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, eating and living healthier can help eliminate some of the worst risk factors for the most serious brain diseases. But the key is starting early. High cholesterol and high blood pressure may begin hurting your brain as early as your 20s. By your 60s and 70s, when the damage can become apparent, it may already be too late. Like so many other organs, the brain possesses a miraculous ability to heal itself, to forge new synaptic connections around old ones, to learn and relearn. That is, however, if you don't keep damaging it 3 times a day. A wholesome diet and exercise may offer your best hope for remaining sharp and healthy into your twilight years. Thankfully, I can conclude this chapter on a happier note than how it began. Despite our family history, both my mom and my brother Gene now eat a healthy plant-based diet, and my mom shows no signs of succumbing to the same fate of brain disease that claimed the lives of her parents. Although Gene and I know that one day we'll eventually lose her, given her new healthy diet, our hope is that we won't lose our mom before she is gone.